Okay, we are live. Hi, this is William Ramsey. Welcome to William Ramsey Investigates. On today's show, I have a very special guest, somebody I haven't spoken to in a while. His name is Jason Horsley, H-O-R-S-L-E-Y. And we're going to talk about this kind of curious documentarian, Andrew Jarecki. And I've also invited a friend of mine, Roberta Glass of the True Crime Report, to sit in. She's very familiar with a lot of these kind of cases, a lot of the kind of innocence fraud or innocence ambiguity type cases. And Jason reached out to me. He's been writing about this subject. So I'm going to put links to his Substack, very popular Substack. Title of it is Children of Job, Where Faith and Hubris Meet. So I'll put a link to that. It's childrenofjob.substack.com. But Jason and I, we've done past shows. We've done covered a number of his books, not some of the recent ones, but the older ones. One is Seen and Not Seen, Confessions of a Movie Autist. Another was A Self-Made Messiah Unveiled about Guru John D. Reuter. And there's been some updates about him. I think he's in jail after we did our show about him. And then another book that we covered was 16 Maps of Hell, The Unraveling of Hollywood Superculture and with a Rough Draft of the Exit. And then another is Vice of Kings, How Socialism, Occultism, and the Sexual Revolution Engineered a Culture of Abuse. And then, let's see, we also did Prisoner of Infinity, so it's five, UFO Social Engineering and the Psychology of Fragmentation. But again, we're going to kind of talk about these cases. I've seen Capturing the Freedmen, but I saw it before kind of the idea of some of these not very forthcoming documentaries came to my mind. So I watched it back in the day, but you can see it if you're watching this on X or Rumble or Rockfin. The title of the documentary is Capturing the Freedmen. Who Do You Believe? And this was a very well-received. Jason writes about it. It won a bunch of awards and was very popular. He kind of launched his career, if I remember correctly. But again, also Roberta Glass of the True Crime Report. You guys should check it out. We've done tons of shows, over 35 shows on so many different subjects that do overlap with this topic. So I'm delighted to have her. But Jason and Roberta, welcome to the show.
Thanks, man.
So people who've listened to my show, they know Roberta. But Jason, maybe you can kind of give an update what you've been working on, the books that you publish. I know you put out a Kubrick book in the last time we talked. And then kind of what led up to kind of your inquiry into this documentarian, Andrew Jarecki, G-A-R-E-C-K-I.
This is book-wise, it's KubrickCon came out last year, and then Big Mother came out last year as well. Actually, two books back-to-back, Big Mother, Technological Body of Evil. That's my latest book. I'm always saying last, but I don't think it ever turns out to be true, but we'll see. Most of my, or all my writing currently is at Children of Job, so I'm just doing a weekly essay pieces on whatever captures my attention, really. And I reached out to you about Andrew Jarecki and Capturing the Freedmans because, well, that's what I ended up writing about. And the reason that I put my attention on it was that I had, the Jinx season two was coming out, and that made me want to revisit season one because I'd written about season one when it came out, just more or less as a cultural analysis. I wasn't digging into the background of either Durst or Jarecki at that time, but I never published that piece. So I dug it out to publish it, time it with season two of The Jinx, and then one thing led to another. I started looking to Robert Durst more thoroughly, and I was surprised by what I found out about Robert Durst. I mean, there was just a whole lot of stuff, his background, his family, that wasn't talked about in The Jinx. So then that made me more suspicious of Jarecki. There's a number of circumstances around how Jarecki ended up making this documentary about Robert Durst that were quite odd. And of course, the famous ending reveal where basically Durst convicted himself on microphone without realizing it. There was a huge coup at the time for Jarecki. I was there among the audience, who's really impressed by that and curious about it. Anyway, because I was looking into Jarecki I revisited Capturing the Freedmans, which was his breakout film. For those who don't know, it's about the family called the Freedmans who were living in Great Neck, that's New York State. And the father was caught ordering porn on child porn online, and the FBI sort of set it up so that they actually delivered it, registered, he had to sign for it. So he convicted himself in that way, and then they searched the house and they found the stacks of child porn and other things, paraphernalia and so on. And then one thing led to another, because Arnold Freedman was giving classes, computer classes for children, boys, in his house. And actually Elaine, the mother, I found out while researching, was also running a private daycare center in the house. So there was a lot of children coming through that house. Anyway, the Jarecki documentary essentially was celebrated. It was very successful for being on the fence, for not making up its mind, supposedly, leaving it to the audience to decide, this ambiguity, this artful ambiguity. And when I first saw it, when it came out in 2003 or four, I was quite impressed by it. And even though I knew about satanic ritual abuse and the kind of cover-ups around that, I actually fell for it. I thought that it was a case of police ineptitude or worse, and sort of moral hysteria and, you know, the usual suspects. And that not Arnold Freedman was obviously guilty up to a point, but Jesse Freedman, his son, was also charged, and he confessed and he was convicted for also abusing these children in the computer classes. And Capturing the Freedmans essentially, it tries to exonerate Jesse, despite Jarecki's claims. It really is slanted. The more I looked into it, the more I realized he'd stacked the deck. He was concealing all this evidence that really did implicate Jesse as well as Arnold. And so anyway, that's just, it was one of those cases where I just started out with something I thought was just going to be a brief piece. And then the more I dug, the more I found, and the more I had to write. So I ended up writing a series of four pieces, probably about 10,000 words, just an enormous amount of stuff, really, implicating the Freedmans, but then also Jarecki by association, complicit with a cover-up, I would say.
Interesting. Yeah, and it was 2003. Sorry, go ahead, Roberta.
Yeah, I just want to add to that. This was 1984. The search into Arnold Freedman started in 1984, but his home wasn't searched and he wasn't arrested till 1987. So it didn't start online. I think it was, my understanding was some kind of like pen pal. He had some kind of pen pal relationship going with other pedophiles. And what Jarecki's film did, in addition to getting a lot of awards, was it had the DA in Long Island. It was so successful at creating doubt, is what I'm saying. It had the DA reopen the case after Jesse Freedman. And that was really where the film cast doubt is. Okay, so certainly the father was a pedophile, but did they do both of these things together? And was Jesse involved? And Jesse was in prison, just got out of prison after the film was released, and they reopened the investigation with this was all Jarecki's money put into pushing for this. And the DA came out with a report that was so damning that, and they collected a bunch of people to look into it. And this will make you laugh, William Ramsey. One of the experts looking into the case was none other than Barry Never Say Guilty Sheck from the Innocence Project.
Oh, no.
Signed off on Jesse Freedman's guilt. That's how overwhelming it was.
Wow.
And I really encourage people to read the DA's report. It's still around. It's just absolutely shocking. And I mean, I don't want to monopolize the time, but there's a lot of very interesting things that we can talk about that are in it.
Yeah, it's incredible. It won the Grand Jury Prize for Documentary 2003. So, and it still has a very high approval rating on Rotten Tomatoes and very well received. But he left it ambiguous at the end, right, Jason?
Well, yes. I mean, this is supposedly his strategy, his approach was to let the audience make up their minds. But essentially, I mean, rewatching it, it was ambiguous. He left it open in the sense that he didn't make it clear. The film didn't make a deciding statement, but actually the emphasis on the film suggests that it emphasizes sort of the least credible testimonies and leaves out a whole bunch of credible evidence. Now, of course, we wouldn't know. I didn't know about the credible evidence. I didn't know that Jerky didn't actually talk to the majority of the victims. For example, I didn't know that there were other suspects who were charged, or at least under suspicion, or didn't get to charging stage, others who had confessed even. I didn't know a number of different facts that were left out of the documentary. So yeah, it has a sort of a plausible veneer of ambiguity until you find out what he left out, and then you compare that with what he chose to leave in.
Right, and this was something that took place kind of in the kind of witch hunt narrative, like child abuse hysteria, right? So this wasn't, the Friedman event wasn't some kind of lone event, right? So it's like McMartin and all these other ones, and there's allegations of occult abuse and things like that, right?
Well, I mean, the timing was certainly tight, and the 80s was timed with that. The actual Friedman case, I mean, certainly as presented by Jarecki, but even fairly objectively, it didn't have obvious associations with anything large scale, anything organized. It did seem to be just a father and at least one of his sons who were, you know, opportunists. They were taking advantage of children under the guise of these computer classes. So, I mean, certainly you could speculate that they set up the classes, or Arnold Friedman set up the classes in order to abuse children, and he had a history of child sexual abuse, probably starting with his own children. But as far as it being part of a larger network, there's no obvious evidence for that. However, the more I looked into it, the more it did. There were certain implications. I mean, I don't know if we'll have time to get to them all, but in terms of the Friedman's background and how they ended up in a very shishi wealthy area of the US. I mean, I don't have all the facts in my hands, but Great Neck is a place where people like Francis Coppola, and it's a very prestigious area. And somehow they ended up there. And so these weren't just ordinary children, that they were children of very prestigious, you know, wealthy parents. So that's unusual, I think, if we're just going to think of it as this sort of, random case of pedophilia. I had another point, but I lost it. So.
But those house prices in Great Neck right now are like $1 million houses, right? So right. It's not...
Oh, I know what it was. It was the brother, David Friedman. Like, he's the number one clown in New York. I mean, still, even after all this, but at the time, he was the most, like, celebrities like Susan Sarandon and Eddie Murphy back in those days. I don't know who, Bruce Springsteen. This guy was clowning for these very high, I mean, the highest, the A-listers. And yet the way that the film presents the Friedmans, I mean, I always had this impression they were not quite white trash, but, you know, very kind of lower class, or at least lower middle class sort of family. That's the overall sense that you get from the documentary, that this is more like, you know, a case of child abuse in an environment that's very far from what we know of you know, the high level organized child abuse. But in fact, it's not. And that's an odd thing. Like, how did this David Friedman become the number one celebrity clown? How is he still that even after this? Is
right. Silly Billy, right? Silly Billy.
Yeah. Right. And Capturing the Friedmans was originally going to be about Silly Billy, the clown. And he didn't want to talk about his family, but as he got closer to Jarecki, he spilled the family secret, and the documentary changed focus from David Freeman to Jesse and Arnold Freeman, with David Freeman just being sort of a cheerleader for his dad and brother's innocence. And that's what also comes out in the DA's report, is how much the brother of Arnold Freeman lied. Yeah. He was told by Arnold Freeman, when the investigators came to his house, he says, "Jesse's guilty. You're going to ask me how I know. The reason I know is because Arnold told me, and he told me not to tell until he died. But at the time he was already dead. So I don't know why he said he didn't want to paint his brother as a monster. He totally remembered being molested. And on the film, he's saying, "I don't remember my brother being molested. Nothing's coming to me." Sort of does this kind of like play acting, touching his head and going, "Oh, it's just no memory of this molestation," where he remembered everything. So there's one of the problems with capturing the Freedmans is having these unreliable narrators out to sort of make the family look more normal and more sympathetic. Yeah.
Yeah. One thing that doesn't come out in the documentary that seemed to be key to me was that, despite the fact that Jarecki obviously makes the point, the fact that the Freedmans were filming themselves all the time, because that's how he was able to make the documentary. He had all this footage to use. The fact is that almost certainly, I'd say almost undoubtedly, they were making child pornography. The abuse wasn't simply, as I say, opportunist pedophiles taking advantage. It was some sort of operation where they were creating child pornography. And well, that implies, you know, a client base and all the rest of it, if not compromise, what have you. But so that, I mean, that being left out is another huge thing. As far as the David Freedman, also what Roberta was saying there, that's Jarecki's story, that he was making a film about David Freeman and just happened upon this. Ross Chait questions that, I think, correctly, because there's a woman involved. I was looking for a name, but I couldn't find it. But the woman who I thought maybe Roberta was going to mention it when she said, "You guess who was one of the people defending?" The woman who wrote for Village Voice, who also has a history.
Debbie Nathan.
Yes.
Debbie Nathan.
Thank you. She has a history of, how can we put it, spinning these narratives. Her language is actually pedophilia apology, really. I mean, it's quite overt, but yeah. She was, as far as we can tell, she was already a friend of the Freedmans. And so it seems by implication she's associated with Jarecki. It seems by implication that, or at least it's worth speculating, was Jarecki actually brought in to make this film? And so then they had to come up with a reason how he happened to stumble upon it, and hence David Freedman became right. The excuse.
That's the cover story. Wow.
And Debbie Nathan, I mean, that's just, she is the pedophile apologist, sat on the board of the Center for Reason and Justice. And now that it's become so unpopular to champion the innocence of pedophiles, she's changed direction, and now she's a border expert. And if you look at her bio, there's no mention of pretty much all the work that made her famous, which was all this saying that basically every case of pedophilia or daycare molestation was mass hysteria and satanic panic. And yeah.
Right, Jason mentions her book, right? It's, what is it, very livid
in
name.
Silence.
Satan's Silence, Ritual Abuse and the Making of a Modern American Witch Hunt.
Yeah.
Wow. So it's these same characters pop up in this. I had no idea.
Yeah.
Chait and Nathan, wow.
Yeah. We should probably mention as well, as we've got such limited time, the Jarecki families. Well, first of all, not direct connections to Robert the Durst family, but certainly in the same circles, New York Jews, very powerful, very rich. So definitely you would expect them to be moving in similar circles. But specifically the Jarecki family's connections to Jeffrey Epstein, like this, I don't know how many of them show up in Jeffrey Epstein's Black Book. And Henry Jarecki, who I believe is Andrew's uncle, as was has actually been placed on the plane, you know, the Lolita Express plane with Epstein. So Jarecki, he's by no means just some,
like random, like objective outsider, right?
Yeah, exactly. He's going to know stuff about what goes on in these circles. He couldn't not know it. Therefore, yeah, he can't please.
And he's also very closely involved, right? Like there's pictures of him with Durst, and he's close to the Friedmans too. So I wouldn't say that he's like purely kind of like an objective guy who's far from the scene trying to write something. He's almost like he's in the stories.
Yeah.
Almost like the two guys who did the West Memphis 3 stuff. Like, what were their names now? What were the two direct mockumentary directors? Do you remember? Bruce Sanofsky and... name. Anyway, but yeah,
I mean, his name is right. Hold on,
Berlinger.
Can I say something about the pornography? Because I think it's key. Is that when they search the Friedman home, and there's one area, and I want to say it's some kind of cabinet or like cubby up above the stairs. Excuse me for not remembering it totally, but. That was totally empty when they came, I believe, the second time to search the home.
Yeah, that was Silly Billy's magic cabinet or what have you, supposedly.
He said, yeah, right. Yeah, so I think there's a lot. And Jesse Friedman and his lawyer, when they went to visit him in prison, Arnold Friedman, they were begging him to say, where did you put all this material, the pictures, because the pictures were taken. And I don't think it's too far-fetched to say film might have been taken. We can only speculate. And he wouldn't give up the location of his, I guess, his life's work as a pedophile. So even to help his son's defense.
Yeah. Well, I mean, as I said, I do speculate a lot, and looking into Arnold Friedman's background, that you'll both be familiar with Jimmy Savile, I'm sure, that there's certain parallels. I mean, they're not enormous, and obviously Jimmy Savile was a huge figure on the landscape of organized child abuse, and Arnold Friedman is relatively tiny. But in terms of his background, like he was in the music industry in the Catskills, which of course was a Jewish place where Jewish people could go, wealthy Jews, during that period. And that seemed to be his rise, was a musician in a rumba band or one of these bands. And then somehow from there, he ended up in a relatively short period of time, meeting Elaine, marrying her, ending up giving these computer classes to extremely wealthy, family kids. And then when you have all this other, obviously what comes out later, and that he seems to be involved, not just in, I mean, one of the reasons that Jarecki, one of the ways that Jarecki was able to debunk without appearing to debunk this case was that he presented the claims of the victims without letting us hear them, except one particular victim who seemed to be chosen for the fact that he didn't seem credible. And making them seem so sort of exaggerated that they couldn't possibly be true, like the number of different number of victims and so on and so forth, over this period of time, that Jarecki frames it in such a way that it couldn't possibly be true. But actually, when you look more into it, it becomes more and more credible over a long period of time. And particularly if you add, there were multiple abusers, and that these children were groomed over time, and they were threatened, and so they, we kind of know, everybody here, and maybe a lot of people listening, we do know the SOP, the standard operating procedure of these kind of operations, and there are a lot of convergences with the Friedman case, even though, as I say, Jarecki makes it look like just this lower middle class home where some bad shit happened and stories got exaggerated. But what I was trying to get to was that if it did involve making child pornography, then that's potentially a much larger operation. And then it's possible that that would account for how Arnold Friedman went from this kind of lowly Jewish rumba magician in the Catskills, who couldn't, you know, barely afford his mortgage, to living in this very ritzy part of town, somehow getting all of these wealthy families' children to come for computer classes. Because otherwise it's kind of odd to see, I mean, to understand how he ended up having access to so many children for such a long period of time.
Right. Do you know how long he ran these this computer class thing, or computer education classes?
I don't have the exact numbers, and if Roberta has, but I'm thinking like 20 years or
something. Oh, wow. And you wrote that he like thought of himself as some kind of like sympathetic pedophile or something like that. Isn't that right?
Well,
was it you or somebody else wrote that?
I mean, certainly there were those who, I mean, even Jarecki, I think his take seems to be, well, Arnold Friedman, yes, of course he was a pedophile, but ... Well, I mean, Debbie Nathan actually makes the statement that whatever Arnold and Jesse Friedman did to those children, it was nowhere near as bad as what many parents do to their children just by, you know, not being good parents. At least he was loving them. That's
wow.
Sorry. I probably shouldn't laugh, but I mean, that's Debbie Nathan's kind of logic, and that, and Jericho is very close with her, so he does seem to have, this does seem to be that angle with Arnold Friedman. Yes, okay, he was a pedophile, poor Arnold, but right, all of this is clearly exaggerated. There's no, he doesn't make any argument, any case, it's interesting actually, for why the children would lie, why they would make up these stories or imagine them. I mean, except, of course, because of satanic panic, it's already implanted in the collective consciousness in the US that what satanic panic is, that the police manipulate the witnesses. And he introduced this idea of hypnosis, which wasn't true. Actually, hypnosis wasn't used to get the, you know, complaints or what have you, the witnesses,
the testimony or whatever.
Testimony. No, it wasn't. I mean, hypnosis was involved at certain points, but it wasn't instrumental in terms of extracting any kind of testimonies. So anyway, what was I saying? That he I've lost my thread there. It'll come back, but
right. But I mean, the
yeah,
pardon me,
just the satanic panic, that he's using that. He's kind of sort of counting on that the audience have that already, that the preconception or that prejudice that, oh, when these cases come out and they're so extreme, that's because the witnesses were coached, right? And so it was police malpractice, but he makes no case for that. He makes no case for it. I mean, there's a couple of things he cites as evidence which are very fishy, but it would be a huge thing. It should be a huge thing. Like, you have to present a lot of evidence if you're saying that the police essentially created masses of work for themselves just so they could persecute this poor pedophile and his child, right? What's the motive? It's not offered.
Right. Interesting.
Right. And they also don't really give context. So most of these acts were done in the room off of the computer classroom, and I don't think he could have given classes for 20 years because it just with the timing of 84 and 80, I mean,
no, 2000
radar in 87, so I mean, that's, it had to be over, you know, maybe five or less years here if he got busted in 87. I mean, computers were just coming into the landscape, right? Yeah. So also, you know, they said that it was so outrageous that this was done in full view when a lot of the abuse wasn't done in full view. And there's lots of other context to it. And just this kind of got glossed over. I know that Jason mentioned it, but just to reiterate it, that there was another accused person who pled guilty, who was Jesse's friend, Ross Goldstein. And when you leave an entire other participant or co-defendant in this case out, I mean, and call and say that you're just you don't have a stance. You're just trying to be fair, even-handed. And as I'm listening, I'm noticing there was an article written by Harvey Silverglate, who's a notorious defense lawyer, who's defending a lot of these kind of characters. And he's saying he was upset because it was he didn't make a strong stand for innocence. Yeah, he made a strong stand for innocence, but just under the guise of being even-handed and not taking a stand. I mean, the conclusion that 9 out of 10 people make when they watch Capturing the Freedmans is that it was a moral panic. That's not a coincidence.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
You're right. It was it was about 6 years or so. I just found a paragraph that would be useful just to read quickly from The Secret Life of Arnold Freedman. You see, there was a lot of good reporting at the time, but you won't find, I mean, sort of honest and balanced, and you won't find it on the internet now. It's all been scrubbed, but you can find it through the archive or sites that collected it. And this was a particularly good article, The Secret Life of Arnold Freedman. It says, in 1981, Freedman was hired by the Great Neck School District to teach personal computers in the adult program. Why was he hired? Doesn't say. By the next year, he was appointed coordinator for the program's 20 or so computer classes. He always had high enrollments and positive ratings, officials said. So when word went out in Great Neck that Arnold Freedman was offering private computer classes for children in his home, teaching general know-how and basic programming, there was no shortage of takers. Police said the classes took place for about 8 years, starting around 1979. Hundreds of largely college-educated, upper-middle-class professionals, doctors, lawyers, business executives, and entrepreneurs enrolled their children. Why? Don't know. Officials estimate there's about 500 youngsters, the great majority of them boys, participated in the classes.
Wow. And it didn't Jarecki only, like, include, I think you wrote he only included one victim statement or one testimony of a victim in the entire documentary, isn't that right? So he didn't really focus on the
he didn't even talk. I think there were about 15 victims who testified, and he talked to less than five. He didn't even remember how many. He said maybe it was two or maybe it was five. I mean, he claimed not to remember. So
interesting.
So do also, Henry Jarecki has been accused of rape, so too. Just a little side note, very recently, I'm looking at an article from June 2024. Accused of rape, Jarecki says relationship was consensual. What a shocking defense. At 91, the billionaire Dr. Henry Jarecki, the owner of Guana and Norman Islands and the Virginia Islands, strangely, he owns islands too, has been sued in the United States court by a female model who said he raped her in New York and sexually abused her on his private island. I wonder where he got that idea, in the Caribbean years ago. It's a 17-page lawsuit filed Monday. So this is just recently. I sent it to you in the chat.
Okay.
If you want to take a look at it. Anyway, so I mean, I just always thought it was very interesting, having attended the Ghislaine Maxwell trial. I thought about it often, you know, why, you know, Jarecki's name came up and being on the flight lists and just the connection. I just thought it was such an interesting, as Jason brings up, such an interesting connection that his father has big connections to Epstein. And then he's doing the pedophile apologist documentary that, you know, the, you know, most watched pedophile apologist documentary ever made.
Raised the question for me, of course, is what was he doing with the Durst thing? What was going on? Because essentially I end up concluding that Jarecki is some sort of fixer. Like, I mean, Capturing the Freedmans was quite a breakthrough documentary. I mean, if you think now we're in a culture where true crime documentaries, of course, are huge, but back then they weren't a big thing. So that was one of the, and it got nominated for Academy Award and everything. So it's almost as though he created a template with Capturing the Freedmans for all kinds of the power of the documentary to mislead and to create these narratives that, of course, they distort, they cover up the truth, but they also reinforce a larger narrative that we all know about here, which is the sort of nothing to see here narrative, right?
Right, right.
And so true crime, and you can't overestimate how much power and influence true crime, Netflix, etc., has in shaping public perception over these things. And of course most people know about Epstein through Netflix, right? However they can spin it, they will spin it. If there's too much evidence, they can't completely make it look like there's nothing to see, but they can still control the narrative. So yeah, I wondered and I've speculated, like, how did Jarecki end up doing the Durst thing and why? Because it seems as though, I mean, first of all, for those who don't know, he made a fiction film about Robert Durst with Kristen Dunst and Ryan Gosling, which was a failure. He was trying to, commercially and critically, I think he was trying to become a Hollywood filmmaker, and he obviously must have had some strings pulled because he did a big production with big movie stars. But the film tanked, essentially. But the story goes, Robert Durst saw it and contacted Jarecki, and that led to The Jinx, season one, which was Jarecki's breakthrough. I mean, he became this huge cause célèbre after Jinx won. So how did that happen? Like, was that some sort of bait for Robert Durst? One can only speculate, perhaps, but it certainly does seem as though, if Jarecki's a fixer, then he's given jobs to fix, right? So what was he fixing with The Jinx?
Right, good point. A documentarian fixer. God, incredible. In this whole stream of like innocence fraud and all this manipulation of these crimes that goes back all the way back to capturing the Freedmans, West Memphis 3, Serial, Making a Murderer, Amanda Knox. It just goes on and on. I haven't seen Wilderness of Errors. That's a whole nother story. Let me see if I can find that.
But yeah, Errol Morris. Yeah, it's very sus. So,
I even questioned the Thin Blue Line after reading Wilderness of Errors. Right. Your Jarecki makes a documentary out of that to make Jeffrey McDonald. Even he couldn't really follow through with all of Errol Morris's nonsense, which was in his book, where he just made up evidence. He even told Gene Weingarten that he knew he does a whole chapter on one key piece of evidence and how it was interpreted wrong. Which is the pajama top, if you fold it another way. I won't go into it anyway. And Errol Morris goes, yeah, that remains on my mind, meaning I knew it was BS, but I put it in the book anyway. And then it becomes an FX series where half of the series is based on Errol Morris's ridiculous apologist to a family annihilator.
That's what the Durst biographer, whose name doesn't come to mind, but said about The Jinx. He said that Jarecki was reporting all kinds of stuff that he had discovered wasn't true. It's just Durst's version. As, for example, when his mother committed suicide, Durst remembered it one way, like he was just standing there watching it with his father or something like that, but actually there were police there and the whole, anyway, it won't mean anything to listeners particularly, but just the fact that Jarecki kept a Durst version, even though there was plenty of evidence that it wasn't accurate.
In the trial, he tried to tell that story of watching his mother commit suicide and waving to him on the roof before she jumped. Yeah. And then he went on to even sentimentalize his family memories more, saying he played hula hoop and was it Uno with his family, which weren't invented yet. So he got absolutely destroyed in Cross by D.A. Lewin. On that, I think it's actually featured in the second Jinx.
Which doesn't seem to have done much for Jarecki, as far as I can tell. Like, it seemed like he needed a hit after so many years, but Jinx 2 didn't amount to very much, really, in the end. One thing I wonder, with Jarecki's involvement, right, were there at least two things going on. One, that Durst wanted to look good. That's clear. He was vain, narcissist, psychopath, etc. And Jarecki was kind of promising, yeah, this is going to make you look good. And it did make him look good until the end, right, in a way. I mean, people sort of liked him and they saw him as charismatic and so on. Certainly it made him famous. So that was going on. I mean, Jarecki obviously was waving a carrot for Durst to get him to cooperate so that Jarecki himself could have his hit. But is it possible, I mean, has anyone considered, or have you considered, Roberto, that the Durst family were actually setting up Robert Durst? They wanted to get him out of their hair and also to scapegoat him or patsy him, because what I looked into indicated that Durst, he really was a serial murderer. It wasn't just these three or four crimes that came up in the Jinx, but he was actually a suspect as a serial killer, which obviously is a whole subject unto itself, for years and years before, well, long before the Jinx. And his family seemed to know about what Durst was up to. So obviously that's a much larger area for research and for a documentary that we're not going to see on HBO.
Right. I know that's a theory. When I interviewed Deputy DA John Lewin, who's known as King of the Cold Cases, he's been exiled by George Gascon for speaking out against his pro-criminal policies. He's one of 50 prosecutors, I believe, who has a lawsuit against George Gascon, the DA in Los Angeles, for a retaliatory transfer, meaning like you speak out against his policies, which are, you know, William Ramsey can talk more about the effect they've had on California, his pro-criminal policies.
Disaster.
You get transferred. So, but I asked him about that. He felt that Durst killed for a very particular reason. And it was generally the last two crimes were to cover up the murder of his wife, which he was desperate to control. I don't know. I have considered it. I haven't looked into any of the, I've listened to some of the theories about them. And it's hard to go beyond a theory, because you're trying to investigate so late into the, I mean, I know cold cases get solved, but, you know, so late into the game and, you know, now he's dead. I think that what's going to be more interesting is the civil suit that the McCormick family has against the Durst estate, and what becomes of that is going to be very interesting. And I know that they're very angry at the DA, the way that the Durst case was tried. Susan Berman's murder was tried, you know, in conjunction with the Jinx. You know, do you understand? Like, they waited till the Jinx finale to arrest him right after. So, yeah. I mean, it's a little bit problematic when you have a movie and a real life investigation going on at the same time, and you're coordinating them. It almost, so the trial becomes part of the, not only just part of the story, but part of the lore of the entertainment. It's a very fuzzy line there.
Good point.
Yeah. I mean, he was going to run right after the Jinx. They had to do it, but that they held off arresting him till after the finale is kind of, you can't go, right? Right.
The documentary or the mockumentary or whatever is influencing court actions or police actions. It's incredible when you think about it. Like, what's going on? Like, couldn't you have done it before? Like, how many people is he rumored to have killed, Robert Durst? I mean, we know, like, there's Berman, and then there was the person in Corpus Christi too, right?
Right, but he got acquitted of, but he right. clearly said he murdered him, Morris Black. So, I mean, that's not up for question. Morris Black, Susan Berman, and Kathy McCormick Durst. Those are three that I feel that we can safely say he murdered. Mm-hmm. Now, I know he's innocent legally until being proved guilty, but I think that his actions and what really the Durst trial proved is that he murdered all three of those people, and that, you know, it was pretty much a wrongful acquittal of Morris Black, which was interesting that the trial of Susan Berman became a trial of everybody that he murdered, really, truly. But there's also a woman, there's a young woman that he's being accused of murdering, that people say was talking to a man in a, who looked like him on the side of the road in an area that he was in. I don't know these. You can see I'm very vague on details, but I know that one. I know there's a couple more.
Yeah, there's three women that went missing around a similar time, and he was somehow, he was definitely a person of interest, let's say, in all three of them. So obviously it's very far from conclusive, but it's still in a deep background on Durst.
And what's the status of the McCormick civil case? Do you know, like, it's been filed though, right? Is that correct?
Yeah, they've done depositions, and what's come out in that depositions has been, you know, explosive. So
have you read those depositions? What's in them?
Well, that DA John Lewin, it was heartbreaking for me because I had done so many episodes with him, had stayed at the Durst, Robert Durst's wife's home in Long Island, her, you know, in the Hamptons. He says with his daughter as a vacation, but it's just, and he says it was done after, you know, you'll read the same article and first it will say before he convicted him, and then it'll say after he convicted him. And so I don't know. I don't know. After he convicted Robert Durst and before he died. So while it was going into appeals, the prosecutor who prosecuted Robert Durst, who up to then had a great reputation, stayed with Robert Durst's wife in the Hamptons, he wow. says, with his daughter. So it was his daughter there? Were they having some kind of relationship? It looks like it. And when it was, it's hard to come down. It was very explosive. And the McCormick family lawyer is constantly railing against John Lewin and very angry on Twitter. And who says, just wait and see, there's more stuff to come out. So I don't know, you know, and John Lewin has made no statement on it. So, other than what's in the deposition, he feels that he did nothing improper. It was, he said Durst was long dead, and but you know what the facts of that are very hazy now.
Gotcha.
But it brings up an improper relationship, a more personal relationship, when you're prosecuting someone's husband to have a close enough relationship that you'll stay in their home.
Yeah, no question.
Anytime is very, very fuzzy and very unwise.
Yeah, for some, especially for a prosecutor, you should know better.
Right.
Yeah. Wild.
So did he get, I mean, did they have a sexual relationship? Did they have a romantic relationship? I mean, these are the questions that come up. Was he just absolutely enthralled with the Durst riches because the home is quite, you know, huge? Did that? But I think anybody with any kind of moral compass would say that that's a bad idea. And if it was done before Robert Durst died, because once you die in California, I'm sorry to kind of derail this, but I'll, I hope I'm not derailing. Once you die in California, the conviction is vacated. It's mentioned in the Jinx too. It's kind of a heartbreaker because the trial was so long and so incredible and involved, and such hard work was put into convicting him. He dies, and then it's like it never happened. It's sort of sad for me, at least. But do you do it before? Are you so sure that Durst is going to die that you're okay with possibly, you know, green lighting an appeal? You know, had that come out when they were appealing the case, had Durst lived, that information could have been very damaging to the case.
Right. Yeah, no doubt. What else you guys got about this whole Jarecki? I mean, what do you know what he's working on now? He covered himself up on the whole, like, more this thing, right? This guy's obviously a killer, McDonald, Jeffrey McDonald. So they tried to whitewash this, right?
I don't know. I mean, yeah, I don't know a great deal about it. What was Jarecki's involvement with that?
He was the, what was he? It's in one thing and not the other. It's off his, like I said, off his IMDb list. But it's, if you go to the Wilderness of Error Wikipedia, he wrote it. Mark Smerling directed it. And I believe that he produced it too. He just wrote it.
So what did Errol Morris do then? I thought he was the main guy.
I guess they bought his book to make into a documentary, because originally Errol Morris wanted to make, he's very close, speaking of, which is interesting, we're coming full circle. Yeah. He's friends with the guy who just, I just mentioned his name, Harvey Silverglate. He's really close with Harvey Silverglate, who used to represent Scientology for a minute. He's the lawyer representing Scientology. He represented Jeffrey McDonald for a long while. So his belief, I guess, influenced Errol Morris's belief. I just think Errol Morris wanted to bamboozle the public and get Jeffrey McDonald out based on a lot of nonsense, saying it was all a rushed, sloppy investigation, and it was basically too celebrated and the book written about the case made it impossible for Jeffrey McDonald to ever get a proper appeal, which he did get an appeal where he did get out, but I think that was before the book for a little while. And then it turned the other way and he went back. Joe McGinnis's book, he went back in. So, you know, there's a lot of evidence against Jeffrey McDonald. He tried to make it look like he killed his family and his pregnant wife, Colette McDonald, and tried to make it look like a Manson-like killing.
Right. That's my take. Yeah. I have to go back and revisit that. Go ahead, please.
I remember, I mean, I read the book a long time back, and there was that TV show, and because he was in the military, obviously, so it certainly seemed as though, my impression anyway, was that if he was guilty, it wasn't just a sort of rogue crime. I mean, didn't it seem a bit like a military psyop of some kind, particularly with all the media coverage? I mean, I'm really speculating now because it's been so long, but it just seemed like there was definitely more to it just than that. He killed his family and then blamed it on a Manson murder thing. And it's still around. I mean, there's a story. This is 2020, so it's not long ago. They're still milking it.
Yeah.
For whatever reason. Jason Blum was one of the producers. So obviously he's very, very high up the totem pole.
Yeah, Blumhouse.
As we're talking about here, it's very difficult to separate true crime from psychological operations from entertainment media. I mean, they all bleed into each other. It's a circle as well, because they create the media that then supposedly inspires the crimes, or they just base the psychological operations on certain movies, and then they create movies and TV shows, right? It just keeps sort of feeding into itself.
It's a good point. I mean, how much of these true crime things are really entertainment? You know, and true crime is the number one genre podcast, I think, for sure. But there's definitely these are like, they take a true crime case and structure them to turn them into like you mentioned, cause celeb, or get the attention of the public and hook them into this ginned up narrative on a lot of these cases. Some of them were cut and dry, like making a murderer, that guy was guilty as heck.
I haven't watched that one, but I mean, I watched a number of the serial killer ones, John Wayne Gacy and Ted Bundy. I write a lot about serial killers and 60 Minutes of Hell a bit because of Mindhunter, the David Fincher show, but then Ted Bundy, particularly in Big Mother, and I mean, the Netflix, the documentaries, they just always leave out the stuff that links these characters to government, to military intelligence, how they've been protected, right? And how there's more than one involved. They get blamed for crimes they didn't commit. They get away with crimes they did. If you want to create a streamlined narrative, which is basically the serial killer, which obviously movies and TV shows have been, they've been creating that narrative as well as these real events. I mean, the Zodiac Killer is one of the best examples, because that was mixing up fact and fiction even while it was happening. Something like Dirty Harry coming out. What was I saying? You see, I get confused just trying to talk about it. But yeah, just the streamlined narrative is right. The serial killer is a crazy guy that's got the FBI BS behavioral sciences profile. This is what Mindhunter was all about, was pushing that narrative, and the book is the same. It's fake. It's bogus. It is BS. There really aren't these profiles that they talk about, because there aren't these lone nuts who just go around killing and torturing women for fun. It's Project Phoenix. It's been going on since the 60s, and as I say, the cover story that they create around these operations have to do with drug trafficking as well, obviously child trafficking, and Henry Lucas obviously is the big smoking gun there. The cover-up narrative also becomes the narrative for these movies, right? So of course it's fiction as a cover-up, but it's also good fiction for movies, right? So which comes first? I mean, yeah, of course they would want to work with Hollywood people, or people who are in the intelligence whose job it is to come up with good cover story narratives would want to go to Hollywood. It's going to be two-way traffic.
Right. Hatcher makes this interesting comment. The meta-narrative of all the work cited here is the gestalt image of, quote, it's impossible to really know anything for certain, isn't it, unquote. And I think that's true. That's another one you can add to the cover-up narrative. It's also the ambiguous narrative, right? Like, oh, there's nothing more. Like the capturing the Freedmans didn't go into enough detail. It's more of like, just like he's a, I think that if you look at Drecker, he's kind of a cover-up artist, right?
Yeah.
Like he gets close and covers the stuff up, doesn't go into some of the details that I think are crucial to the cases.
I'm just on a very superficial, I mean, I'm not, you know, this is not my area, as you know, these kind of, I know that these theories are out there. I just don't follow them. But I think on a base level, what Mindhunter did was make the public believe that you can get into the mind of a killer. And I just don't believe, you know, they're unreliable narrators there, and make it believe that profiling is a key part when it's used very, very, you know, very seldomly. Mostly crimes are solved by, you know, old fashioned police work, not, you know, some kind of, also Silence of the Lambs did this, made it seem like serial killers were some kind of exceptionally brilliant people that we needed to get in the minds of to solve the cases. But we actually even watch Silence of the Lambs, or even it's more clear in the book that all Hannibal Lecter did was derail it. And John Douglas, we've talked about John Douglas, well, William Ramsey, and his bogus. I mean, he did a profile of the West Memphis Three and said they never committed a crime before. I mean, his profile was false from the get-go.
Yeah.
And he goes around giving lectures with Damien Echols and Amanda Knox, both hanging out with these killers. I mean, there's something, I think, you know, what I've been talking about on my podcast is this, it's okay now to, I think the press has gotten behind the idea that we no longer can support sexual predators, but murderers, you know, you can get behind. I don't know what, and not ruin your reputation. I don't understand it. It just seems like there's this kind of moral exception. We've now accepted murder as somehow like a mistake, or I don't know, something, you know, a bad luck. and we've totally downplayed psychopathy.
I think it's a trickle down thing. I mean, the term I use is superculture. There's a superculture, and our culture is downstream from the superculture. And in the superculture, psychopathy is, you know, is a job requirement. If you want to operate at that level, you have to go through the forms of initiation that do involve a kind of savagery. And it's the savage noble. It's not the noble savage, but the savage nobility. And this is a satanic ritual abuse, I think, is all about this. Like, they have these practices that they do together. And so that's trickling down into our culture. I don't know much about Amanda Knox, although I did watch the documentary. I was probably fooled by it. But there's certainly people who aspire. I mean, people sense that. Natural Born Killers was all about that. They sense that actually at the higher level of the society, killing is not only prohibited, it's mandatory. You have to be a killer. I mean, you think of it as, often we think of it as figurative, but I don't think it's figurative. I think it's literal to a large degree. And so I think that's what we're seeing. And Douglas, to me, I mean, based on that book, he's just lying. I don't think he's naive or deceived. I think he's lying. And he talked about the Atlanta child murders, and he said, we actually know what, you know, certain things that's going on there, and it's really dark and it's really terrible. Why didn't he say them? Why didn't he say what he knows? It's like he just wants to have that power to let, kind of hint at the fact that he's in this higher echelon of the super class, posing as this good guy, this white hat. But yeah, of course he's fraternizing with murderers and psychopaths. I mean, I know that sounds a bit simplified and definitely very cynical, but it is the impression that I have ended up with.
Yeah, I think the cynicism is warranted. Like, it's very strange that he's just the West Memphis 3, but Amanda Knox, we did a show on, Jason, we did a show, me and Roberta, on Amanda Knox when she was on Joe Rogan, and just rolling Rogan over and over. I mean, we also did a show with Damian Eccles talking to Tim Pool. Like, that was a two-hour journalistic catastrophe, but people can listen to those. But Douglas is something else. But guys, we are at the 60-minute mark. Is there anything else guys would like to add on this Andrew Jarecki conundrum or ambiguous world of Andrew Jarecki?
That he didn't want to testify in Durst's trial. He fought it, and eventually the state said they weren't going to call him. And that's, I've always tried to get to the bottom of why he didn't want to testify in Durst's trial.
That's interesting, right? Yeah, me too. I would think that he'd want to testify.
Wouldn't you want to get justice for Susan Berman, absolutely, for her murder?
You would think. So that adds to the sus quality of the whole situation. How about you, Jason? What would you like to add?
Nothing is coming to mind as far as specifically Jarecki, and I think we've covered quite a lot. I mean, my interest in Jarecki and Capturing the Freedmans and all this material really is... it's kind of just to develop a better lens just for looking at the information we're getting. So I think it's a good case study. I found it to be a useful case study for, you know, what a fixer might look like, how he might operate, and what one of his jobs looks like and what it does. So that's my interest, rather than the specifics of the injustice and all that, because I just think we live in a world in which injustice is par for the course.
Yeah, endemic.
But it is very useful, particularly if we're imbibing this media. Because, you know, I still watch Netflix true crime, and I can't remember with Amanda Knox. I'd have to rewatch it or something. But does it spin it like she's innocent? The documentary.
Yeah.
The
Then
I did fall for it, because I don't remember thinking, that's a bit of a con. I remember liking the documentary, so I probably fell for it, you see. And that's one of the reasons I wanted to look at Capturing the Freedmans, because I actually reviewed it back in 2004 and I fell for it. And I consider myself very discerning, but I think we're all susceptible to this kind of master spin that they develop. They develop this incredible ability to spin narratives. And if you're not really watching closely, because we want to be entertained, you just get sucked in. And as I say, it's a cumulative. The more fake narratives we fall for, the more it creates this sort of matrix in our consciousness, whereby we are seeing things through that matrix. So it's very pernicious, very pernicious. So that's why I wanted to look at it. And by the same reckoning, you know, the more disinformation, myths, or whatever we call that, you know, that have been installed in us, the more of those we can bust open and dissolve, the more we'll free up our cognitive faculties, because they've been severely hijacked and co-opted and impaired by all this propaganda.
There's a lot of it. I mean, it's really incredible. When you look at the whole kind of map of this kind of innocence fraud, true crime, they're just almost all over the place. There isn't really an honest one. It's hard to find a really objective documentary producer with integrity to tell the full story.
Yeah. Did either of you see the American Nightmare, a recent thing?
Yeah, I did an episode on it.
Oh, good. Well, I should check it out, because that seemed very, very fishy, that whole story.
I know. I thought this is going to be the basis story of more innocence fraud. You know, he acted weirdly. You know, the guy acted strangely. They were so terrible, law enforcement. I don't know. I don't know what the full story is there. I don't know if we'll ever hear the full story. The guy said he acted with a group, but we've never heard anything from it. I don't know.
Yeah.
I thought it was interesting. Well, yeah,
it's very credible, because it did look like a psyop, to use that term. It looked like some sort of military operation that they've been doing for years all over the place. But yeah, you should check it out, Bill, as far as something that might be made for a future show. Because somebody messaged me about it. But I said, well, there's only so many hours in the day, because once you start going down any given rabbit hole, you never know when you come up again, right?
True, very true. Right. You definitely went down to the Jarecki rabbit hole. There's no question about that.
I did feel personally affronted, I must say, I suppose, because I fell for it. But also, Jarecki, I mean, relatively, he's got a pretty pristine reputation, and he doesn't deserve it. He absolutely has not earned it. So I did feel like somebody should point this out.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think you're right. What have you been working on, Jason? You can see your work here. I think it's on the screen, is The Children of Job, or Faith and Hubris Meet, right? So that's your Substack.
That's my Substack. Yeah, that's where everything is happening. I'm doing a Jobcast, a weekly podcast, and weekly essays, which is just whatever I'm currently drawn to write about. Currently, I'm back on Hollywood as the counterfeit religion. Just this, as I say, the larger thing is how we get psyoped, gaslit, what have you, how we get colonized internally by these narratives that we buy into. So that's generally, and I go all the way back to the Bible. I mean, I personally think the Bible is more good than bad, but I think we need to look at all of the things that have shaped us psychologically. So, Children of Job, it covers a very broad spectrum, from the Bible to natural born killers. And that's
quite the spectrum right there.
Yeah.
Well, how about you, Roberta? Are you still on YouTube, True Crime Report? And
I live stream 5 days a week, every day but Monday and Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern. So that's where you can catch me on my YouTube channel. I'm also, you can listen to me on podcast, anywhere where there's a podcast, Apple Podcasts, et cetera.
And
et cetera.
X too, right? Like you
follow me on Twitter, Roberta Glass Pod. Yeah, and I'm streaming on X. Yep. Yep. Yep.
Been busy. There's the Facebook. Amanda Knox, Facebook, right? Yeah. You haven't been banned off YouTube. Good for you. I seem to.
No, I've been banned off of Facebook. I've been, you know, banned off of Instagram, but not YouTube yet.
I'm done. I think horrible. I'm just on to Rumble now. I don't know how many sites they've taken off, but
I'm constantly fighting with them, you know, constantly being demonetized and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But so far they haven't squashed my whole channel.
It's just not worth the grief. But thank you both for Yeah, thanks for showing up, Roberta, on short notice, and glad you met Jason. But we talked. It's Jason from the Children of Job Substack. I've interviewed him 5 books. How many books do you have now, Jason?
Oh, God, about 12 or something. 12?
Oh, wow. Yeah, it's been a minute. 12 books, and then Roberta Glass and I have done 35 or 40 shows, so people can listen to those. But I'll put links to both of your stuff. But we talked about the ambiguous world of Andrew Jarecki. So thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, Bill. Good to meet you, Rebecca.
Yeah. All right, stay there.
Nice to meet you. Thanks.
Stay there.